Hello, I'm Scott Trout. This is number 0296, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0296. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, former child star turned meteorologist Ross Hull reminisces about the beginnings of his acting days leading up to Are You Afraid of the Dark?
I started when I was basically 5 years old in the industry. I did modeling, flyers for Zellers and that sort of thing. And that transitioned to commercials. And there was a point when I was 13 or 14, you know, I was starting to get zits and starting to get to that awkward stage. And my parents basically gave me the option. They said, you know, you can continue doing this because, you know, it's hard, especially when you're going through that awkward stage because you feel more self-aware when you go to auditions and that sort of thing. And my parents gave me a choice. And I said, you know what? I want to keep doing this.
Filmmaker Matt Smiley and his documentary, Highway of Tears, about the plight of missing and murdered Aboriginal women.
A week before we premiered in Toronto, the numbers across Canada was over 600 missing and murdered women. Then it went to 900. Now the official RCMP numbers, I believe, were at 1,087. And then there's certain activists as well that have done their own research. The numbers are over 4,000. So that to me is number one, 4,000 too many. And there's a definite need to focus on this because it's a corrosion through our society.
Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and Book Banter celebrates 40 years of Saturday Night Live with a splendid cocktail book called Saturday Night Live, the book. So get ready to shout out live from New York, it's Saturday night! It's coming up later on the Stuff File Program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0296, was Scott Trout, a television director at Global News in Edmonton, another place where I work. Thank you very much, Scott, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff. And I should mention right off the bat that this first story could have easily been the idiot of the day, but I chose not to make it that, only because the person in question already proclaimed that he was an idiot, and self-realization automatically brings it down a notch. Okay? But suffice to say that if you're driving around in your car with a large amount of gunpowder on your front seat, perhaps you shouldn't light a cigarette. Now, it's unclear whether Joseph Brennan of Massachusetts was planning to make a bomb. What is clear is that he blew himself clean out of the driver's door of his Toyota Camry when he lit a cigarette. A bystander heard the explosion from a block away and came running. They found Brennan, with singed hair and burns to his face, lying in the street next to his burning vehicle. "I'm an idiot," was the first thing Brennan allegedly told a bystander. "I lit a cigarette with gunpowder in the front seat." See, there's the self-realization moment that I was telling you about before. And once again, what Brennan was doing with loose gunpowder is unclear, but according to the bystander, he risked his life to go back to his wrecked vehicle, where he allegedly removed multiple items and put them in the trunk. This, of course, did not deter the police, who searched Brennan's car, where they removed 14 liquids and powders, some of which, when combined, could create what they called a destructive device, and what you and I would probably simply call a bomb. Brennan allegedly told police he had gotten various materials from a friend to tinker with. "I wasn't going to do anything malicious," he said, according to the report. Police Chief Theodore Ross said in a statement that law enforcement searched Brennan's house and found precursor components, detonators, and one complicated incendiary device, although Brennan's Facebook page shows an interest in rocket propellants, so it was probably harmless tinkering. Well, bomb or amateur rocketry, he certainly found a quick way to remove all of his body hair. And he has a lot of explaining to do. Meanwhile, police in Georgia said a bullet fired at an armadillo ricocheted off the animal's armored hide and struck the shooter's mother-in-law. I bet he couldn't do that again if he tried. The Lee County Sheriff's Office said 54-year-old Larry McElroy fired his 9mm pistol at an armadillo Sunday night, and the bullet bounced off the animal's armored skin and went through a fence, a door, and a chair to strike 74-year-old mother-in-law Carol Johnson in the back. Investigators said McElroy was about 100 yards away from Johnson's home when he fired the shot, which killed the armadillo, by the way. Bill Smith, an investigator with the sheriff's office, said Johnson was not severely injured. She was walking around on her own power and talking. Smith described the case, which did not lead to any arrest or citation, as simply bizarre. Just the circumstances, just all the way around, the whole situation was unusual, Smith said. He went on to say, shooting at nuisance armadillos is not against the law, but McElroy might want to use a different gun next time. I really think if they're going to shoot at varmints and whatnot, maybe use a shotgun with a spread pattern with a lot less range, Smith said. Wow. Armadillos are often seen as a nuisance by those whose lawns and gardens have been targeted by the skilled diggers. Now, how often and for how long do you think old Larry is going to have to beg for forgiveness from his mother-in-law and his wife, by the way? He's never, ever, ever, ever going to hear the end of this one. Ever. Ever. And we have one more item in the Stuff File News, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A 47-year-old Ohio man has been charged with robbing a suburban Cleveland bank. The same bank he pleaded guilty to robbing in 1999 and for which he had served a prison sentence of nearly 6 years. Larry Hewitt of Garfield Heights and his alleged accomplice, 33-year-old Marcus Wright of Cleveland, were indicted in federal court for robbing an Ohio Savings Bank branch last November of $6,240. They were arrested in December by members of a federal fugitive task force. Now, Hewitt also is charged with brandishing a firearm and being a felon in possession of a weapon. He was convicted of robbing the same Richmond Heights bank of $163,000 back in 1999 with a different accomplice. Well, if at first you don't succeed, you know what they say. However, I have my concerns about Marcus, the accomplice. I mean, how does Larry convince him to go along with robbing a bank that he had already spent 6 years behind bars because of a previous bank robbery attempt for? I mean, how does that happen? Shouldn't that be a sign that Larry is perhaps not up to the task? Just a thought, folks. Just a thought. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? In my other life as a global news anchor, I get to work on a regular basis with global meteorologist Ross Hull. But Ross has a not-so-secret past that many are probably aware of. Before he started occasionally scaring us with the weather, he was scaring us as one of the stars of Are You Afraid of the Dark? He was also one of the stars of Student Bodies. Ross joins us on the line right now from Toronto to talk about his career as a child actor. Hi, Ross.
Hi there, Peter. Great to be with you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So I've had an opportunity in the past to talk to several child stars or former child stars, and it's interesting to find the direction that their paths take after initial success as an actor. Some people stay with acting. Some people go behind the camera. Some people get out of the business entirely. Was it always your intention as a kid to be an actor, or was it something you just did when you were a kid?
It's interesting. I think it went through a couple of stages, really. I mean, I started when I was basically 5 years old in the industry. I did modeling. I know it's hard to believe that I could have actually pulled off modeling, but I was on in flyers for Zellers and that sort of thing. And that transitioned to commercials. And there was a point when I was 13 or 14, and I was starting to get zits and starting to get to that awkward stage. And my parents basically gave me the option. They said, you can continue doing this, because, you know, it's hard, especially when you're going through that awkward stage, because, you know, you feel more self-aware when you go to auditions and that sort of thing. And my parents gave me a choice, and I said, you know what, I want to keep doing this. And I did keep at it, and eventually the role in Are You Afraid of the Dark came, and Student Bodies, and all those things. But the thing is, I wasn't really a child by that point. I was more 17, 18 when those roles came around. So I was a bit more aware of what was going on. And then I made the transition after acting to meteorology, but I did take a bit of a break in between.
Well, let's talk about the fact that when you first got the job on Are You Afraid of the Dark, and you're at that age, you were not a kid, as you say, but still, you're a teenager, you have
right.
friends, you have other peers. What's it like being a teen actor, as it were, on a hit television series? How does that affect your life with your friends who are not actors?
Well, you know, I think it was sort of, I was always involved in acting. I did theater and all those sorts of things. When I was in high school, I wasn't on any sports teams. I wasn't very popular either. And theater was really the only way I could make some kind of connection with the student body, no pun intended. So, you know, they always sort of saw me in that circle. And when I started Are You Afraid of the Dark, I was shooting this TV show in some studio in Montreal, but no one really knew what it was about. And even the first couple years it aired, when it started airing, it was on the Family Channel here in Canada, and not a lot of people had a subscription to the Family Channel. Some people did. And in fact, one of my friends on the show, Rain Perry Cool, who also lived in the West Island where I lived, had a subscription. So we actually started watching the show, the first episodes of the show on Family Channel. So it took a few years before people actually knew, you know, recognized me from Are You Afraid of the Dark. And one of the funny stories that I tell people is, people who remember Doogie Howser, that TV show, I was often recognized as Vinny, Max Casella from Doogie Howser, more than any other character like from Are You Afraid of the Dark. But eventually, as those shows started airing over and over and over again on YTV and other channels, then that's when people started recognizing me, and I guess people started, you know. But my friends never treated me any differently, and certainly my family didn't. Always, you know, ready to put you back to earth.
When did you realize the popularity of the show? Because as you say, it took a while, right?
That's a good question. You know, I guess it was when I started getting recognized on the street. And, you know, I took the plunge and I went out to L.A. for a couple of pilot seasons. And I was actually recognized in Los Angeles for... you know, for being an actor. And to me, like that, because actors are everywhere there. Actors are serving you lunch. Actors are pumping your gas. I mean, actors are everywhere. And the fact that I was actually recognized there made me realize, okay, well, this show had some kind of impact, especially in the U.S. And Are You Afraid of the Dark, especially, you know, its popularity on SNICK, which was the Saturday Night Nickelodeon. So that's when I went, wow, you know, this show is certainly reached out to people. And then recently, when I have actually gone to the U.S. for a book launch that was basically a book based on a lot of the shows that were on Nickelodeon back in the day. And, you know, hundreds of people went to this thing from all over the U.S. And that's when I realized, wow, the show is still in the psyche of people. People still remember it.
Now, there are a lot of people out there who are former actors or current actors who go into the world of weather presenter, but you went further than that. You went meteorologist route.
Yes. I always had I mentioned that acting was something that I did as a kid, but I always also had a passion for storytelling, for journalism. I would go around, doing mock newscasts with my video camera that I got. That was one of the most exciting gifts that I ever received from my parents for Christmas. And so I always had this passion for broadcasting. I actually did it while I was shooting Student Bodies. I actually did a pilot for YNN, which was the youth news network, which I don't believe ever got off the ground. But I think they did do a few things. It was basically a network that was designed to reach out to high school kids in Quebec, I believe. And so I always had a passion for it. I just couldn't do it because of acting, because acting kept me busy. Then I went to Ryerson University in Toronto, and that sort of opened the door to broadcasting for me. I got a job at the Weather Network, got my last year of school, and I guess I'm one of those people that I like when I'm into something, when I'm doing something, I want to know as much as I can about it. And I annoyed the meteorologist at the Weather Network so much with my questions that they said, hey, why don't you just become a meteorologist yourself? So I started the Mississippi State University program, and that allowed me to pursue my meteorology diploma.
Your desire to want to be a journalist, to want to be in broadcasting, how interesting was it for you to play, albeit a newspaper person, in student bodies?
Yeah, I mean, my character was a bit wacky, so I don't know about his journalism skills, but, you know, we tackled some pretty big issues on that show, and I think that's what I'm most proud of about Student Bodies is the fact that TV's changed a lot since we were shooting that show in the 90s and just up until 2000. And, you know, we had an episode where Nicole, Emily, had a gay friend, so lesbian friend. We dealt with that. We dealt with a character who had some issues with alcohol. A lot of things that some of these shows at the time, and some shows even now, don't deal with. So, I think in that sense, it was interesting being a part of that show and also the evolution of Student Bodies. It sort of started out reaching out more to tweens, but then I think our age range sort of increased, and it was comedy. We kept things light, but I think we also did try to do some more serious stuff.
I saw a video that you did, so I'm going to ask you the question, and I'm just curious to know, are you tired of hearing people ask you the question, are you afraid of the dark?
Did you just ask me that?
Yes, I did.
I think you might have even thrown it in a couple of throws when you anchor when we've anchored together.
Actually,
I don't think you've actually done it that way.
I've never done it.
You've never made a reference? Okay.
I've never made a reference to it.
You know, I don't get tired of it. I think when I get annoyed is when people are rude about it, basically. I mean, you know, and it was a little tough for me when I first started at Ryerson. People were like, what is this guy doing here? They didn't see past my television, past. And, I walk around the halls and I'd hear someone say, yell out student bodies or, are you afraid of the dark and all these things. And those are the situations where you're like, come on, but overall, the answer to the question, I guess, is no, I'm not. And, but I'm probably more afraid of that question than I am of the dark.
Ah, okay. Now, you're again busy as a meteorologist. You also get to do some other things. It was interesting seeing you interview your former cast members for a segment. That was also interesting as well. Do you ever envision yourself doing acting again, or is this the future you see for yourself as it is right now?
I would be open to it. I never would close the door to it. I think one of the things I didn't like about the acting profession, and this is ironic considering the broadcast industry is certainly not the most stable of industries these days, but I just didn't like the audition process of really not knowing. Like, I had done a couple of TV shows. I'd established a bit of a name for myself and so on, but it felt like you had to start from scratch. And I didn't like that process of auditioning and not knowing what was going to be happening. So if that's one of the reasons I've sort of undertaken doing this YouTube project, because it's a means for me to be creative but also sort of control my own content and do it at my own time. So if the right role came along, and I'm not saying I wouldn't audition for anything, but for me to sort of give everything up and just say, okay, well, I'm going to be an actor, from this point forward, I think that would be a little scary. No pun intended, once again.
As time goes on, we just got about a minute. I just want to ask, as time goes on, if you ever have an opportunity to see any of your old shows, do you get to see them objectively, or do you think about what went on that day when you were shooting, or what was going on behind the camera, or do you get to enjoy the shows for what they are, like the general population had a chance to?
That's a really good question. I think it's all of what you mentioned. Sometimes a certain scene will bring back something completely random that was happening just before a conversation before I was having with a cast member. Or I'll say, my God, why did I say that line that way? Or why was my hair that way? Or, all that stuff. It's really hard to look at it. But now that the years have sort of gone on, and, it's almost 25 years since Are You Afraid of the Dark first aired, I am kind of seeing them for the first time. And especially recently, because I had to look over some episodes for that YouTube video I prepared for Daniel DeSanto and Alicia Cuthbert. You kind of forget about some of these scenes and do see them for the first time. So it's kind of exciting. But there's always that other eye, that performer's eye that's going, okay, that wasn't right, you didn't do this right, or, you know, all that stuff.
Well, we'll continue to watch you on Global with the weather. And you can continue to
stick. As scary as that's been, I know. But it's nice that spring is finally starting to, spring weather's finally starting to arrive for us in Montreal, so that's nice.
Ross, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Okay, thanks, Peter.
That's Ross Hull, star of the classic TV shows Are You Afraid of the Dark and Student Bodies. And these days, you can see him on Global News in Toronto and Montreal.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to filmmaker Matt Smiley about his documentary Highway of Tears. And Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. And lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio. The smarter way to listen to radio. Well, in the last few years, a crime wave has infiltrated New York City. After the deer population exploded, residents started reporting dead deer, many with heads or antlers cut off, as trophies by poachers. The problem was so common, the state's Department of Environmental Conservation appointed a 3-officer team to hunt down poachers. After a year of investigation, the team say they caught one with a bow, dressed in camouflage, behind a neighborhood playground. 47-year-old David Oakes of Staten Island, dubbed the Urban Elmer Fudd, became the first person in New York City's history to be convicted of poaching. "When you're poaching behind a playground," a source told a reporter, "you're not really taking public safety into consideration." Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. Wait until wabbit season starts. Yeah. Meanwhile, Burger King is paying the expenses and providing gifts for the wedding of an Illinois couple with an interesting connection to the fast food restaurant chain. Joel Berger and Ashley King accepted the company's proposal. The couple have been known as Burger King since they were in the 5th grade together. The couple announced their engagement this spring with a photo next to a sign at the local Burger King restaurant. Although a woman's name usually comes first in an engagement announcement, they decided to flip their names. A Burger King spokesman says the company felt an overwhelming urge to help the happy couple celebrate their upcoming marriage. The Burger King nuptials will be held July 17th in nearby Jacksonville. Now, even though the fast food chain is paying for the whole shebang, I hope the couple will, you know, have it their way. Yes. And in March, two men serving time for anti-gay murders became the first same-sex couple allowed to get married behind bars in Britain at the Full Sutton Prison in East Yorkshire. The romance blossomed between the two men, Mark Goodwin, age 31, serving life, and pedophile Mikhail Galantinov, age 40, who is eligible for release sooner. Now, they met in the prison library, and the wedding party included four relatives of the two killers. Now, I really have nothing to add to this, although I'd love to hear the thoughts of the families of the victims. I mean, these guys are in prison for anti-gay murders, and they're getting married to each other. Okay, let's just move on. Most people don't understand the smiling mugshot, says Nancy Suzanne Duarte, age 41. She's speaking about her own mugshot taken after her arrest for arson in Dallas, Texas. She admits she went to American Power Yoga and set the place on fire because, she says, it was, quote, the place that had brought me so much pain and suffering, unquote. It wasn't the yoga that pained her, but rather a man who, she says, kept harassing her. He kept hitting on me and trying to make me his girlfriend, the girlfriend on the side, because apparently he was married, I guess. Even as I'm walking out the door, he kept trying to put his hands on me, and I was like, no. It went on for years, she said, and she apparently decided that the studio itself was at fault. Just to set it on fire, just to destroy it, get rid of the devil's temple, was her motive, she said. Her only regret, despite bringing gasoline to help, the place didn't actually burn down and will reopen quickly. A studio spokeswoman said Duarte had not complained to anyone about anything or any of the harassment that was allegedly perpetrated toward her. Of course, they'll reopen quickly, and probably with a new sign that says, New Hot Yoga Room. And by the way, I've seen her smiling mugshot, and I swear, I haven't seen toothpaste models who look that happy. Really. Seriously. Anyway, time for one more Stuff File News story in this section of Stuff File News. Before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And it's a couple of stories that deal with undignified deaths. You know, we often mention these on the program. Two of them, to be precise. Wayne Clark, age 52, collapsed and died in January of an apparent heart attack seconds after walking into an Aldi grocery store in Edgewood, Maryland, and announcing a robbery. At his home, police discovered evidence linking Clark to two earlier robberies. And undignified death number two, Anthony Stokes, who was only 17 years, died in March from a car crash injuries as he was fleeing Roswell, Georgia, according to police following him. They were following him after a home invasion. Stokes drew national attention in 2013 when, in order to receive a heart transplant, he promised to turn around his until then criminal life. And if you do the math, he was what, either 15 or 16 back then. So, yikes. Life of crime, and he's only 15, and he promises to turn things around after a heart transplant. Well, soon after that surgery, though, he was posting thug selfies on Facebook, and in January of this year had been jailed for possessing stolen property. So, to 52-year-old Wayne Clark and 17-year-old Anthony Stokes, I've got just one word for both of you guys. That would be karma. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Since the late 1960s, at least 18 women have disappeared and or been murdered along a 724-kilometer stretch of Highway 16 in northern British Columbia. None of these cold cases were ever solved until 2012, when a special RCMP investigation was able to link DNA from one of the murder victims to deceased U.S. criminal Bobby Jack Fowler. But that's just one case. The rest are still mysteries. That road of highway has become known as the Highway of Tears. That's also the name of a documentary by Matt Smiley that looks at the plight of those women and many other Aboriginal women who have simply disappeared. Matt joins us on the line right now from right here in Montreal. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. This is a very serious issue that does make the news, but it seems to be, and maybe you feel differently, that not a lot is done about it. Would you agree?
I definitely agree. I think in the last couple of weeks, and I'd even say the last few months, there has been a little bit of focus on it, which has been a big shift definitely over the last 3 years. It's become somewhat topical across Canada, but there's still a very big division in how these cases are even reported. You know, there are still women going missing and being murdered across the country. I think CBC has just started to do a great initiative in terms of covering the stories in a special segment. But I've definitely found that a lot of these cases are still pegging these women as victims, and that dynamic sort of needs to shift.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that the main issue right now is that the public perception is that they're the ones that are putting themselves in danger, and I don't think we're not taking credit from ourselves as a society in terms of putting them in danger by not having proper, adequate, you know, public transportation or health and social services to protect them, let's say, if they are in an abusive relationship or if the home life is not exactly perfect and they're trying to escape. Most of the time they'll come to a city center where there are predators, and this is, you know, not specifically along Highway 16, but more Canada-wide, where they are preyed upon.
So to put it in more simplistic terms, it's similar to an assault victim being blamed for what she was wearing.
Exactly.
Okay. So what brought your attention to this, and what made you decide to make this movie, Highway of Tears?
The nucleus of it really started with a tree planter who is Nicole Hoare, and my sister and brother-in-law both work in tree reforestation, and they were the first ones to really bring up her name, and you know, we were a big group of us out camping near where Nicole went missing, and it was really the look on everybody's face that sort of triggered a curiosity that I had to research her case, because I couldn't understand how somebody could go missing and we couldn't find them. It's true that in northern BC or northern territories, it gets a little bit harder because, you know, the area is so big and there's not that many people. But it really left a void in a lot of the people in the north. So the more I started to research her case, is where the term Highway Tears popped up, and I didn't really make the connection right away, but then all these names started, you know, popping up, and that's where I noticed that it was a much bigger issue than one girl, you know. It went obviously to 18, to over 40, and the numbers are certainly higher, and I'm sure the more that we work on this, the more that we'll uncover and be more specific about the actual statistics surrounding those cases.
You know, even more nefarious than just simply blaming the victim, which society seems to do, do you think part of the problem is the fact that most of these women are Aboriginal, and as a society, we don't think enough of them?
There is a definite disconnection between you know, let's say regular society and the Indigenous population, and there's always a gap, and I think, you know, with regards to them, we do notice it, and it is, it's almost, you know, I can't say it is a fact, but the cases in the past have not been taken seriously. There's definitely been a shift from law enforcement to focus on these cases and to start taking them seriously, and I think that's from education and awareness, but we still have a lot of backtracking to do in terms of, for me, it's not just a reconciliation when we talk about residential schoolings and the effect of that. You know, reconciliation goes, I think, both ways, where our entire society needs to learn a little bit more of their background and why these cases are happening and why they're being put in situations of danger.
So you mentioned that you know, when you went camping, you were hearing these stories and you thought, this is shocking. How can someone disappear like this and not be found? So then you go and make this movie. And of course, while making movies, you have to research the whole situation. So what was the even biggest shock for you, or bigger shock for you, when you started to delve into this? What was the thing that made you go, how is this even possible?
I'm still in shock and continue to be in shock pretty much every day. And the main thing was, is it started, you know, with one girl, and then it went to 40. And then when I started to hear more and more, and obviously now since the film has come out, a lot of families will reach out either through our Facebook or our website. And, a week before we premiered in Toronto, the numbers across Canada was over 600 missing and murdered women. Then it went to 900. Now the official RCMP numbers, I believe, were at 1,087. And then, you know, there's certain activists as well that have done their own research. The numbers are over 4,000. So that to me is number one, 4,000 too many. And there's a definite need to focus on this because it's a corrosion through our society.
You know, with so many cases, do you feel a lot of them are connected, that there's somebody out there doing this because they simply know no one's paying attention and they can get away with it?
There's certainly cases that are connected. Obviously I'm not a law enforcement official can make the links, but certainly with a lot of the law enforcement officials that I've spoken to, you know, there are predators by opportunity, which is kind of is a scary thought. There's certainly a lot of people that are linked, and you know, we looked at it with Bobby Jack Fowler, and then when you start to further investigate, you know, the Picton case when he, you know, was convicted of over 49 women in British Columbia. There's certainly serial killers out there, and it's a really scary thought.
Is this something that is unique to Canada's Indigenous women, or are there similar problems in the United States?
The thing that we found really interesting, and it's sort of where our follow-up is that there are certain parts of the United States that have, you know, similar characteristics. You know, especially in America, there's the Native American population, and obviously off the reserves, there's also, there's a lot of women that are put at risk as well, and especially south of the border in Mexico, even in like Juarez, where women are going missing, they're being murdered, and nobody's paying attention. I think in Mexico is probably worse than Canada and the U.S.
You mentioned both a Facebook page and a website. What is where can people find information about the film?
The film, the best place to start is www.highwayoftearsfilm.com, and from there it links to our Facebook, Google Plus page, and our Twitter, and from there we're going to start adding all our screenings that we have, because next week we have Halifax on the 20th, which we're doing to raise funds for the Loretta Saunders Scholarship Foundation, and then we're going to Whitehorse afterwards. But I think Halifax is going to be a very meaningful screening date, and we've added two screenings on one day, and it is the first day of the trial for Loretta Saunders. And so I think it's important, you know, for the community to come together, understand some of the root issues, and especially the work that Loretta Saunders was working on, because her thesis, when she was working on it in Halifax, was about missing and murdered Indigenous women. So it's tough.
It's a very important story, a very important film. The film is called Highway of Tears, and I thank you very, very much, Matt, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Filmmaker Matt Smiley. The movie is called Highway of Tears, and you can go and find more information by going to their website at highwayoftearsfilm.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0296, and you'll find the link. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. For many years, a minor league baseball club in New York had a nice tradition of giving two free game tickets to any fan who returned a foul ball. As you might expect, the promotion was very popular and usually led to quite a scramble for foul balls. Unfortunately, it also led to a lawsuit. During one game, a fan chased a ball hit outside the park and was injured after running in front of a car. He was distracted because he was wearing headphones and the driver was legally intoxicated, but the fan sued the ball club anyway. The case went all the way to the state's top court before it was finally thrown out. However, it cost the club thousands of dollars in legal fees, and now it no longer gives fans free tickets for foul balls. Let's be fair, a lot of other fun traditions that Americans have enjoyed for generations are being discontinued now because of excessive litigation. With more and more courts willing to turn a blind eye to personal responsibility, you have to wonder what tradition will be the next to go. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And almost live from Montreal, it's Stuart Nauman.
Hey, Peter. Almost live. You know, when I think about that, I think of the Gong Show, because that's how they introduce the show every week.
That's true.
I remember. But I got a question for you, Peter.
What's that?
Where were you on the night of October 11th, 1975?
I would have been working that night, and I would have come home and I would have caught part of Saturday Night Live.
That's right. Well, that was the first episode. I was at my dad's 40th birthday party, which was in our duplex in Ville Saint Laurent the night that it debuted. But you know, yes, you're right, Peter. It's Saturday Night Live, and it's currently celebrating its 40th anniversary season. And over the past 40 years, it has not only revolutionized late night TV, TV comedy, and the variety genre, but it has made superstars of previous unknowns like John Belushi, Gilda Radner, Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, Eddie Murphy, Phil Hartman, Will Ferrell, Chris Farley, Jimmy Fallon, Amy Poehler, and Tina Fey. And has made such original characters as the Blues Brothers, the Coneheads, Rosanna Dana, Mr. Robinson, Fernando, Hans and Franz, the Church Lady, Stefano, and the Spartan Cheerleaders, major figures in contemporary pop culture. And for all that, they have to thank Johnny Carson for making it all possible. Why, you may ask? Because it was in early 1975 that Carson asked NBC to stop airing reruns of The Tonight Show on Saturday nights at 11:30, because it was proven to be not such a profitable venture. So as a result, it created a void in the Peacock Network Saturday night, late night schedule, and it needed to be filled. So to fill that void, the powers that be at NBC turned to two TV boy wonders, Dick Ebersol and a Toronto-born Emmy Award-winning comedy writer named Lorne Michaels. So on Saturday, October 11th, 1975, at 11:30 p.m., with George Carlin as his guest host, although, for the record, he never appeared in any sketches. He just did stand-up. NBC Saturday Night, and the name was changed to Saturday Night Live the following season. You can thank Howard Cosell for that one.
Yep.
Made its debut live from New York, and for the next four decades, it would forever change the face of TV comedy. So to commemorate SNL's 40th anniversary, a terrific illustrated fact-filled history of the show has been published in the form of a very impressive coffee table book entitled, simply enough, Saturday Night Live, The Book. Now, the book is divided into three parts. The first part details the typical six-day creative cycle of how the show has been put together since 1975. Little has changed in the past 40 years when you think about it. The middle part deals with the actual broadcast of the show as we're treated to an intimate look at 40 years worth of cold openings, host monologues, commercial parodies, weekend update, sketches, backstage preparations, musical guests, and short films. And the final third of the book is a virtual SNL encyclopedia, which offers a comprehensive season-by-season, show-by-show chronicle that includes cast lists, hosts, and musical guests, season highlights, and those trademark host bumper photos that bridged each segment of the broadcast. Love the ones in the first five seasons done by Edie Baskin that were hand-colored.
Yes, I remember those.
Yeah, very trademark, very legendary. But to put it simply, this is one book that Saturday Night Live fans must have and will certainly treasure, because what makes it such a treasure is that author Allison Castle was granted access to Saturday Night Live's massive archives and culled over 2,300 images to create a rare yet complete picture of the elements that made Saturday Night Live such a pop culture phenomenon. And there's some great backstage and behind-the-scenes photos. And one of my favorites, it's a rather poignant photo of Lorne Michaels as he's glumly sitting in a sparsely furnished Studio 8H on the night of the final Saturday Night Live broadcast to feature the original cast and crew in May of 1980. So if you only watched the first 5 years in SNL like I have, or watched subsequent generations of the show, or watched it every season, Saturday Night Live the Book is the ultimate anniversary present to its legion of fans, and it gives you a rare behind-the-scenes glimpse to what made this renegade live comedy music TV show tick for 40 years that the average Saturday Night Live viewer was never privileged to witness. It's quite a gift.
I still think, you know, people like to rag on the program a lot. I still think it's a great show. I mean, there are times when it has weak moments. There are some shows which aren't better, which are not as good as others. And there are other shows where they could stop after 12:30. But by and large, I think it still does quite a few things that are rather interesting. Most recently, this week's past show was also another good one. So, I mean, you know, they have their hits and misses. Now, I'm just curious to know, in your opinion, thinking back and looking back, I don't know when the last time was you had a chance to see the pilot, the original, when you think back at it now, looking at that show, do you think it almost has of the feeling of it's like a comedic version of NBC's Midnight Special?
You know what? You know, when you think about it, you got a point there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Midnight Special had top music acts. It had, you know, some of the top comedians around the time who did perform on the show. The only thing that was missing was original sketches.
Yeah, but their flow was almost similar. And you know, we look at Saturday Night Live today and we look at the sets and how it looks now, but it was very sparse back then. And yeah. Midnight Special had a sparse stage when it started as well.
I know. And also, the one thing is that, you know, Midnight Special had a consistent host, Wolfman Jack. You know, while Saturday Night Live had, you know, a rotating, no guest was the same every week.
Right.
No host was the same every week.
Yeah. Anyway, if people want to find out more information on such shows, what other books do you recommend?
Well, I do recommend a book called Live from New York by James Andrew Miller and Tom Shales. It was expanded, revised, and reissued in a new edition to commemorate the 40th anniversary. It was originally published in 2002, and it's a great backstage. This is the gritty stuff. It was told by, you know, the former cast members, Lorne Michaels, the former hosts, writers, guests. Very gritty backstage stories. I mean, this is like, you know, if this Saturday Night Live the Book was the glamorized version, this is the gritty version. And also Saturday Night, which was the first book that was written about the backstage history of the show by Doug Hill and Jeff Weingrad. It was published in 1986. Still luridly fascinating when you read it, because a lot of these backstage stories still stand up. And it was the first time people got to see what it was like to put this show together.
Excellent. Excellent indeed. So again, this book is
Saturday Night Live, The Book, by Allison Castle. It's published by Taschen, great publisher. They do a lot of like pop culture and entertainment oriented books, coffee table books, and it's $49.99.
And in it, do we find out at all if Francisco Franco is still alive?
No, he's still dead.
Still dead.
But I also found out what the samurai's actual name was, the John Belushi character.
What was it?
Futaba.
Futaba.
Yeah.
Okay. See, the things you learn, the things you learn. How do we learn more in finding out what you do on a weekly basis, sir?
Well, you don't have to wait for Saturday nights at 11:30 to find out. You can just read me in the Montreal Times every week. It's published every Saturday, in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, sir.
And live from New York, it's Saturday night.
Now
you hear the sound effects of me stumbling over like Chevy Chase.
Stuart Nauman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed have an idiot of the day, and I'll get to that in a moment. But first, one more Stuff File news story right here, right now. Let's get to it. A Colorado man who wrecked his car, fled from police, and climbed a tree atop a mountain cliff has been arrested after negotiators spent 3 hours talking him down from his precarious perch. 32-year-old Richard Pula Jr. ultimately surrendered and was arrested on suspicion of driving under the influence of drugs and a host of other charges related to the incident. This according to Boulder County Sheriff's Office Commander Heidi Prentup. According to Prentup, police outside the city of Longmont took a call from a person who reported that a motorist was stopped in the middle of the road and was beating on a car with a pipe wrench, breaking out the windows. The person reporting this strange behavior decided to follow the vehicle until deputies were able to catch up. Prentup said, adding that officers followed as Pula entered a canyon about 4 miles from where he was first seen smashing his car. When he reached a parking lot at a canyon trailhead, Pula crashed into a large rock and his car went airborne, coming to rest in a field. He then fled on foot, wading across a creek and scrambling up a steep cliff where he perched himself in a tree about 30 feet above the canyon floor. After 3 hours, negotiators with the Boulder County SWAT team persuaded Pula, who was not armed, by the way, to come down from the cliff and give himself up. Pula was transported to the Boulder County Jail, where, in addition to driving under the influence, he was being held for investigation of failure to report an accident, leaving the scene of an accident, eluding and obstructing police, reckless endangerment, and a parole violation. Yeah, it's just a buffet of charges, you know. And you know, I really don't know why you would need to talk someone out of a tree. I mean, I'm just quite comfortable waiting down below. Either he's going to get hungry and want to come down, or fall asleep and drop 30 feet. Either way, if you're waiting down below, you win. Especially if you're, you know, getting overtime. Now, I was tinkering, just briefly, just mildly, with the idea of making our tree-hugging friend or tree-climbing friend the idiot of the day. But no, I didn't think he really met the criteria for being an idiot. He's dumb, certainly, but not completely an idiot. In any case, that was not the idiot of the day. But, this, boys and girls, well, this is the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
A New Jersey man has been accused of stealing a friend's car to avoid missing a court hearing on drug charges. 21-year-old Jorge Ramirez Sierra of Riverdale has been charged with unlawful taking of a means of conveyance and driving while suspended, among other counts. They always have a suspended license. Have you ever noticed that? Police say the new charges came after a man reported his car missing Friday morning. Police say the man told officers Ramirez Sierra had said that night before that he didn't know how he was going to get to Patterson for a court hearing. While officers were talking with the owner, Ramirez Sierra called to say he was returning with the vehicle. He was taken into custody after arriving. Ramirez Sierra had been arrested on drug charges back in March. Now, why, oh why, would you steal a friend's car to go to a court hearing when you already have a suspended license? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0296. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0296. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You'll also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.